How often does an officer fatally shoot and kill somebody? Well, the FBI is supposed to be keeping track of that, but there is no mandated reporting.
In the absence of hard numbers on police shootings, journalists step in to fill the void. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Also, racial bias informs not just who gets shot by police, but how the media cover violent crimes.
The media oversamples crime committed by people of color and oversamples how often whites are the victims of crime committed by people of color.
Plus, the tale of how libraries became a crucial front in the battle against civilian surveillance.
Have you even seen the ALA's Freedom to Read statement? The last line is, "Freedom itself is a dangerous way of life, but it is ours." Librarians, right? I know!
More coming up. Stay tuned. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Tuesday, Senators Barbara Boxer and Cory Booker introduced a bill called the Police Reporting of Information, Data, and Evidence, or PRIDE Act, that would require states to report to the Justice Department every death or major injury caused by police. To date, the federal government's mandate to gather that information has fizzled, as FBI Chief James Comey concedes.
It's ridiculous that I can't tell you how many people were shot by the police in this country. Last week, last year, the last decade. It's ridiculous.
Journalists to the rescue. Seriously, new data gathered by The Guardian US and The Washington Post reveals just how much we haven't been counting. The Post's report, released last weekend, determined that 385 people died from police gunshots in the first 5 months of 2015. By their tally, police have been responsible for one out of every 13 gun deaths in the US this year. Meanwhile, The Guardian study included not only shootings, but death by other means, such as tasers. Its database puts the total at 470 as of Wednesday afternoon. Kimberly Kindy is a national investigative reporter at The Washington Post.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And John Swain is senior reporter for The Guardian US. Hi, John.
Hi.
Let's start by having you guys explain how this project came about at your respective institutions. Kimberly, you want to start?
Sure. Last year, I was covering Ferguson along with a lot of other reporters. And one of the first things that came to mind was, wow, how often does this happen? How often does an officer fatally shoot and kill somebody? Well, the FBI is supposed to be keeping track of that, but there is no mandated reporting. It's voluntary. So about 3% of local police departments actually report their fatal encounters to the FBI. It's grossly undercounted in their database. So we decided to do our own database, start tracking the information with respect to how those encounters begin, whether it's a traffic stop, whether it's a police officer going on a 911 call because someone's suicidal, but get some real information and maybe provide some answers as to why things are going sideways so often.
The FBI figures have this air of authority, air of officialdom, while being practically useless. There's no information on which departments have taken part, whether some departments from last year have this year not taken part. And so when you get totals year to year, the supposed trends that come out could be completely meaningless, could be wrong. And we, too, thought that, you know, if no one was going to do this, we should do it, too. There are so many interesting stories in these people's lives and in these people's deaths. And sometimes they slip between the cracks. Sometimes if people die in areas that aren't well served by media, if we return to these stories, if we find these stories that kind of passed us by, sometimes there are inconsistencies in the police account of what happened. And this thing's really worthy of investigation. So we thought this would be a repository for our reporting as well as a database.
I'm a little confused. You both said that the FBI data is voluntarily supplied by local police departments, but I understood that the Death in Custody Reporting Act mandated that states receiving federal criminal justice assistance report all the deaths that occur in law enforcement custody.
As far as we can tell, people just aren't doing it. People are not following the law. And, you know, it's incredibly difficult, I'm sure, to coordinate responses to different departments in different cities, counties, states who are just not doing this. This has just fallen by the wayside.
Each of you used different methodology. Kimberly, why did you limit yourself to shooting deaths? And then I'll just pass it on to John. Why did you include tasers and being run over by cars and other things?
We decided to look at fatal shootings because when somebody dies at the hands of police officers, that's the majority of them. And we wanted to make sure that we analyzed something that was as best as possible the complete data set. We thought that we would be able to do some meaningful analysis because it is the bulk of cases and the details of those incidents, it's something that we were able to, you know, track. If you separate out some of the things that the Guardian put in and you just looked at their fatal shootings, we had numbers that were fairly comparable.
We too considered the fact that it's more manageable to limit this to shootings. However, we just thought we could not do this when Freddie Gray, the case in Baltimore that set so much controversy, so many protests and riots, he would not be covered by a database that limits itself to shooting.
Freddie Gray was killed basically being in the back of a police wagon bound and then just thrown around and it killed him.
That's right. And Eric Garner, who died following a physical struggle with officers who used a chokehold on him. These cases were so significant to people. They created so many questions and so much discussion about this issue that we thought our database has to cover these cases.
I think what you're getting at really illustrates how difficult and complicated it is to create a database that's meaningful that will lead us to what we ultimately want, which is a better understanding of why these incidents are happening and if they are preventable. The truth is the Guardian and the Washington Post shouldn't be the ones building this database. We're trying to fill a vacuum that there should be no vacuum to fill.
For both of you, this is going to be an ongoing project, at least for a while, no?
Absolutely. One thing we're determined to do, if we can, is to keep track of investigations. So many times someone is killed, it is announced that such and such department is investigating, and then nothing is ever heard of again. In this past year, one of the main issues that had come to the fore was, when is a shooting justified? When is a tasing justified? And to be able to answer that in a kind of broad way and to see what's going on, we thought someone has to keep track of that.
So far, most of these shootings are still under investigation. Typically, when this happened, it was usually months, sometimes years, before an officer was either charged or they publicly determined that it was legally justified. Mm. But we're definitely starting to see some change in that. Although most of these cases have either been deemed legally justified or they're pending, so far, there are three officers that have been charged with the fatal shootings this year. In all three cases, I should point out, there was video that captured some or all of the incident. They seem to be moving faster and doing it more often, but it's still only three out of about 400.
So we're talking about fewer than 1%. What of the findings you came up with surprised you the most?
20% of our unarmed people, they were running away when they were shot and killed.
That surprised me too. 20%. But as I understand it, police are authorized to use deadly force only when their lives or the lives of others are in danger. So how are these not prosecuted?
When you start reading these sort of case by case by case, what they generally say is that, well, I ran after him, and then when I got on top of him, he reached into his pants pocket, and I thought he was going for a gun, and it turns out to be a cell phone, not a gun. If they can convince a jury that they truly were afraid that the person was armed, even if they weren't, they typically get off.
When it's the word of an officer involved.
Right. The word of an officer against the word of somebody who's dead and is no longer around to tell their story.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a potentially criminally implicated friend or someone like that. And as Kimberly said, the video that is emerging from people with cell phones, people who are just recording as they pass by because they've been watching similar videos, this is changing things. And I think it's really challenging the authority of the word of police.
What about the racial aspect of this debate? Probably the number that's most often quoted is that among the unarmed people who were shot by officers, they were disproportionately of color.
30% of black people who were killed by police and in our database turned out to be unarmed. That was twice as big a proportion of those white people who were killed by police. That is stark. And we need to look into why. You know, maybe there are some police departments where institutional bias exists. And only with this sort of data, I think, can we point to them.
What do you think of the argument made in certain political circles and in certain precincts of the media that all this focus on what seems to be excessive violence by police is actually increasing the danger to police?
I talked to over a dozen police chiefs about this. They said that if the training was different and if these encounters were handled differently, that it would not only reduce the deaths of suspects or victims, it would also reduce the risk for officers. It's not safe for them either when they chase down somebody with a gun and it's unnecessary. It's not safe for them to go get really close to a mentally ill person with a knife. So we're really talking about the kind of analysis that can make things safer for them.
You know, one thing we've talked about really since Trayvon Martin in Florida, but certainly since Michael Brown in Ferguson, is when talking to people in the community, they say, yeah, the media come in, maybe there's some reporting, but nothing ever changes. And I wonder what you think the implications for this data may be.
Attorney General Eric Holder, as he was leaving, said that this situation was unacceptable and something needed to be done. The director of the FBI has said similar. There are petitions from the American Civil Liberties Union, from other campaign groups to make this reporting mandatory.
I think the great thing is they can't just throw their hands up anymore and say, well, we're doing the best we can. Now lawmakers can point to something and say, but wait a minute, The Guardian can do this. Wait a minute, The Post can do this. Why can't you do this?
Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Kimberly Kindy is a national investigative reporter at The Washington Post, and John Swain is a senior reporter for The Guardian U.S.
Coming up, while the media's studies reveal the number of deaths, other studies struggle for causes, one of which is, wait for it, the media.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Reporters are taught to use plain language. We don't say operate a motor vehicle, we say drive. We don't say imbibe alcohol, we say drink. But sometimes journalists get sucked into a rabbit hole of newspeak, embracing euphemisms designed by government to change the subject. Enhanced interrogation tactics was one such. And now, as police shootings fill the headlines, comes another. See if you can spot it.
The officer-involved shooting happened tonight at the Mission Police Station on Valencia Street.
We've got some new details about the man who died in that officer-involved shooting that happened.
This morning, police are looking into what led an officer-involved shooting that killed a former Marine.
Craig Martin is co-director of the International and Comparative Law Center at the Washburn University School of Law. He says the term officer-involved shooting is not just cop speak drifting from the station house to the newsroom, but an intentional blurring of the facts.
If a dog bit a child, we would not expect to hear someone say that a child was injured in a dog-involved biting. That would just be a strange way to report it.
At the risk of belaboring the obvious, why would there be such a convoluted construction?
When we say that someone is involved in some incident, it leaves unclear the centrality of their involvement. It creates the insinuation that they may have played a peripheral role. Their role is uncertain. But in these incidents, there's no uncertainty at all. I mean, they are the primary actor. It's not just the officer-involved shooting as a headline, but also in the manner in which it's used in the reports themselves. I mean, typically it's reported that a man died as a result of an officer-involved shooting, and that compounds the problem. When we say that someone dies, it suggests or insinuates that it's from natural causes, as opposed to saying that someone was killed or to use the active voice, a police shot and killed a person. And the causality in terms of who shot and injured whom is crystal clear. So there's no reason for us to use this sort of opaque language.
On the most fundamental basis, there's bad guys and then there's the police who are that thin blue line protecting us from mayhem. And they are at great risk and sometimes killed. It's not really hard to understand the tendency to not want to immediately affix blame when a cop has shot somebody. Is that what's happening here?
Well, I think that that may be perhaps the instinct that's driving this. But I would suggest that really this unusual, in my view, misleading use of language, you know, has to be divorced entirely from the issue of justification. If a police officer shoots and kills someone and we determine that it was entirely justified under the current standards for the use of force, that should have nothing to do with how we report the fact in plain language.
There are gymnastics going on. Our producer, Kasia Mihailovic, did a little digging. This is not a scientific investigation, but she tried to find officer-involved shooting as a term in U.S. newspapers and wire services. In the 2000s, there were close to 7,200 hits. So far in 2015, with the subject very much in the public eye, 3,400 so far. I do have a theory about this, and one is that officer-involved shooting altogether functions as a noun, and it's a whole lot easier in a declarative sentence, and especially in a headline, to talk about an officer-involved shooting rather than to try to explain a policeman shot a suspect.
Officer shoots man is three words, too, and in fact, it would be a more punchy headline. Officer shooting can also be treated as a noun, and it's two words.
So that's it. Just take out the involved and let officer shooting stand.
Yeah, language matters. As George Orwell has famously written, if we can't write about our politics in clear language, then we will cease to be able to think about our politics clearly. It's important in a democracy for us to be clear in explaining how the institutions of the state interact with us. The agents of the state are killing its citizens at rates that are higher than any other well-developed democracy, and we ought to be thinking carefully about that.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Martin is an associate professor and co-director of the International and Comparative Law Center at the Washburn University School of Law. He's also the author of a recent Huffington Post article titled, Time to Kill the Term, Officer-Involved Shooting.
Nazgul Ghannouch is a research analyst for the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit group that advocates for criminal justice reform. She's the author of a report called Race and Punishment: Racial Perceptions of Crime and Support for Punitive Policies. If the numbers from the Washington Post and the Guardian show that police shootings disproportionately affect African Americans, Ghannouch found that the coverage of those shootings displays racial bias too.
A 2002 survey found that people estimated that 40% of those who committed violent crimes were African American, when the actual rate was 29%. The general public overestimates Black participation in crimes such as burglaries, drug sales, juvenile crimes by somewhere between 20 to 30%. For Hispanics, Americans have estimated that about 27% of violent crime is committed by Hispanics. And that figure actually exceeds the proportion of Hispanics in the prison population. That's 17%.
So why do we think that?
Because the media oversamples crime committed by people of color and oversamples how often whites are the victims of crime committed by people of color. We know that most murders are committed by African Americans against African Americans or by whites against whites. We also know that most murders committed by men and most victims are men. And yet, for example, one study that looked at a major Columbus, Ohio newspaper found that the coverage in that paper tended to pick the most typical cases when selecting perpetrators, so most often Black men, but tended to pick the least common victims, so most often white women.
Only 10% of victims in actual crime reports were whites who had been victimized by blacks, but these made up something like 42% of televised cases in a Los Angeles study.
These disparities have been found in major news outlets, especially in television. So this does a double disservice to the general public because people get an exaggerated understanding of how much crime is committed by African Americans, and they get an exaggerated sense of how likely they are to be victims of those crimes, and they don't have a clear understanding of how often African Americans are victims of these crimes.
You also found that the way people are depicted vary according to race.
Try to imagine a scene from the recent protests in Baltimore. You might think about that CVS, think about people looting, and then turn to the gang shooting in Texas.
The motorcycle gang.
Exactly. And one of the archetypical images from that event was a group of men sitting around, you know, waiting to be processed by police, some people on their phones, right? What happened in Texas, very violent crime. And what happened in Baltimore, large protests, and yet very different types of impressions that we have of the level of calm and peace in those two areas and the level of threat.
A black man who is a suspect is more likely to be shown in custody and less likely to be named?
What's significant about that is that when you have a named white person as a suspect, the problem and the crime becomes more localized. You can associate it with that individual. When you have unnamed suspects, you know, it tends to feed into this stereotype, you know, the myth of a dangerous black man. And these kinds of images contribute to that.
Can you give me any examples where police shootings are at the heart of the story? Is this research applicable to that kind of reporting?
When you think about all of these recent incidents, the problem is what we suspect to be the implicit bias among the officers, the fact that they are looking at the situation and assessing it to be a significant threat. And this is something that FBI Director James Comey has talked about, the unconscious biases that everybody has.
Harvard has an implicit bias association test that you can take online. Millions of people have taken it. They've found that in a majority of people, there is an implicit bias, even if you're convinced that you haven't got one. And it isn't even limited to whites. African Americans tend to hold a sense of fear or negativity when confronted with pictures of other African Americans.
That's right. And what's so important here is that most officers in general are not your sort of traditional bigots. So it's not about smoking out these bad guys, but it's about people like you and me, people who mean well and who intend well, but the life and death decisions in particular that they make is very much affected by the kinds of associations that they have of people of color with criminality, with danger. So when the officer drove up to Tamir Rice and shot and killed him, someone had called in that there is a young man in the park carrying what seemed to be a weapon. It was in fact a toy gun, but the police officer rolled up and with very little attempt to assess what the situation was, what the level of threat was, he shot and killed the young boy. Had the suspect been a young white boy in a park who was called in that way, the officer might have been more likely to first test out the theory that he might have had a toy gun or that there might have been some other way to de-escalate the situation.
Your research also found that whites tend to be more punitive when it comes to law enforcement. Studies have drawn a direct link between the prevailing perceptions of black criminality that you describe and a lock 'em up and throw away the key mentality among white people.
One of the puzzles that I faced here was, why is it that most victims of especially serious crime are African Americans, not whites, and yet whites are more punitive than African Americans? Why would that be? And part of the explanation is that because whites have this exaggerated understanding that crime is committed by people of color, they have less empathy. They're less interested in getting to the root causes of the crime and preventing it from happening again. And instead, they're much more punitive. And so if you look at the research and if you look at surveys, it shows that people of color are very concerned about crime. They're more concerned than whites, but they don't think that more punishment is the solution. Because there's so much emphasis on crime coverage and really so little emphasis on crime policy coverage. When people think about Walter Scott running from the police in South Carolina because he had unpaid alimony payments for which he was liable to be arrested, a lot of white Americans, middle-class folks, wonder, why would you run? I would never run from the police. And so I think that this points to a gap in media coverage to educate the public, not just about high-profile crimes, but also what the consequences of our crime policies have been for these communities.
Nazgul, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Nazgul Gandnoush is a research analyst for The Sentencing Project, a nonprofit group that advocates for criminal justice reform. Recent events suggest that in the matter of police shootings, we may be approaching a turning point. All those people we've spoken to in the past year, people in the affected communities, always concluded by saying, "We always knew this, but nothing ever changes." But now it's possible, just barely, but possible, that they may actually finally begin to detect a difference. Real numbers, we haven't had them before, and a growing awareness that things are not always as the media portray them. At the very least, as we embark on another interminable campaign season, Hillary Clinton has called for a genuine accounting. It was never even a talking point before. It may be wishful thinking, but visions of the dead, first on cell phone cameras, then on the internet, then on your local news, then on the networks, ought to mean something. True, words have proved to be largely inadequate, but pictures and data, and finally, federal grants to police departments, those can be mighty persuasive.
Months ago, we ran a segment about an explosive claim that had gone largely unreported. Allegations in a report commissioned for the peace process of Colombia's long war with Marxist rebels that between 2003 and 2007, U.S. military personnel and contractors had sexually abused many Colombian children.
The investigator cites one case where 53 girls in the town of Melgar were targeted by contractors who filmed the abuse and sold the films as pornography.
That was Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman. She was one of the few to pick up on the story at the time. Despite the horror of the scenario, most of the mainstream press ignored it, prompting many of our listeners to ask why. We wondered, too, and interviewed a U.S. reporter who had written about the allegation and a left-leaning media watchdog who attributed the silence possibly to media deference to the Pentagon and indifference to Latin America. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Adam Johnson.
I just found it curious that no one had mentioned it. The argument I make is that if this report was a Truth and Reconciliation report about China or about Iran or about, you know, Russian soldiers in the Caucasus, this would have been everywhere.
It would be an inexcusable failure if the story proved true. But it wasn't true. Adrian Alsima is the founder and editor of Columbia Reports. His post was the first to pass along the mass rape allegation based on one professor's contribution to that official historical report. While Alsima's post did not get mainstream U.S. traction, it was loudly touted by Russia's RT and Venezuela's Telesur, along with the UK tabloid The Daily Mail. Meanwhile, Alsima himself sought to confirm what had been presented so unequivocally in the official history.
Well, first I tried calling the professor who had put that claim in the report. That professor never responded to any of my calls or any of my emails, which got me very suspicious. After the initial publication, I teamed up with Fusion, which is a daughter of Univision, their correspondent in Colombia, Manuel Rueda, he actually went to Melgar to talk to people there, to talk to the authorities, to talk to the people in the town. And we basically found out that the thing in the report, in the historic report, was basically an urban myth. And I felt responsible for having spread an urban myth.
Now, the allegations were not based merely on gossip or whispers. There were actual porn videos made, and it's unclear how many people were involved and who was producing the videos. The allegation is that it was American personnel. What do we know about these videos?
In 2004, videos were produced that were sold. I found out that there was involvement of actual professional American porn actors. In other videos, there are unidentified men, and those could be U.S. military personnel. However, they could also be people from the oil industry. It's possible that U.S. military personnel was involved, but we are talking about maybe one or two or three guys rather than maybe dozens. What we are looking at is that, like, over the past 15 years that the United States military has been highly active in Colombia, there has been an accumulation of credible allegations, and these allegations need to be investigated.
So something isolated and unsavory was inflated into something vast, conspiratorial, and grotesque. It's not a non-story,
no,
but it's not what it's been portrayed to be.
Exactly. And what happened is that rather than seeing that there were allegations from several parts of the country over 15 years, this seemed to have been condensed to one claim in which suddenly 53 girls were abused by military members. And that just never happened.
So while we were here in the States wondering aloud why there was so little reaction to your story, you were sitting there in Colombia fretting over the overreaction to your story.
Exactly.
But of course, both Russia Today and Telesur have an interest in embarrassing the United States.
Yeah.
And it was a propaganda bonanza for them.
It's kind of their purpose, isn't it? It's in their employer, the state's interest, to question the moral authority of the United States. I mean, that's just their politics.
Exactly. It's like blaming a shark for feeding. But I'm curious about your own culpability, because after all, you ran this story based on the historical document without yourself checking it out.
In an ideal world, I would have verified everything. The thing is that, like, when you look at my website, Columbia Reports, like, this is an indie operation. There are no funds or resources that could support such an extensive and almost forensic investigation of a claim, which I supposed a historic commission would have done. So, I mean, I regret having published it. But then again, I can't blame myself for being an independent journalist and not having the funds to thoroughly investigate such claims.
One final thing, Adrian. Now that you have clarified the record, has anyone along the trail gone back to clarify it as well?
No. And that's leaving me with a really bitter taste in my mouth, because I investigated it myself. When I found out that that claim was an urban myth, I very prominently published that was an urban myth. And there was no follow-up. You're the first American journalist I talked to.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you for letting me talk.
Adrian Alsima is the editor and founder of the English-language Colombian news site, Colombia Reports.
This week, the Supreme Court made its first ruling on a case about the nebulous world of violent online speech. The case hinges on Anthony Alonis, a Pennsylvania man who wrote on Facebook about murdering his estranged wife and shooting up a school. Alonis was sentenced to nearly 4 years in jail in 2011 on the basis that a reasonable person could believe that he wrote, quote, true threats. But he appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that these posts were rap lyrics and therapeutic, not meant to be taken seriously. He even wrote, quote, "Art is about pushing limits." He said his intentions should be taken into account. And at the high court, he prevailed. Dahlia Lithwick wrote about the case for Slate.
They didn't do the thing everyone expected, which was make some grand pronouncement about the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects rap lyrics, or the First Amendment does not protect true threats online. In fact, the court went out of its way to say, you know what? We're just going to talk about the intent requirement in this one threat statute. And in the end, the court said, you can't only listen to the victim. That's not enough, says the court. The court says, we have to look at what Anthony Alonis wanted and intended to do. So it's a big deal. And then they didn't say, here's the state of mind that Anthony Alonis has to have. So they're kicking it back to the lower court and saying, figure out again what the test is without saying what the test is. Get back to us and we'll let you know if you got it right. So even in that narrow context, they didn't clarify.
Okay, so you have this case. The lower court has to determine a test for state of mind. The court decided not to deal with the First Amendment and rap music, which in a way is kind of a relief because what the hell do these 80-year-olds know about the sort of idiom of rap music? I just don't think they could decide. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of a court that actually could. Is that why the court avoided a big constitutional ruling on this case?
Well, it's a really good point. I will say there was an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief that was filed in this case, literally about rap music. This is a court, you know, that loves opera. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia famously go to the opera together. There was a brief, literally, that attempted to say, here's what rap music is and what it would mean to not protect that with the same protections that you'd afford La Traviata. And so there was an attempt, I think, to educate the justices about rap. It's interesting, if you look at the majority opinion that is written by Chief Justice John Roberts, he goes out of his way to not just quote at length Anthony Alonis's rather disgusting screeds about his wife, but he compares them to Eminem. And I think one of the reasons the court just did not want to get into these questions of what's a true threat under First Amendment law and what is rap music and is it different even though it's very violent and what is the intersection between unbelievable violence and harassment women feel online and the laws that are meant to protect them. All of that was swirling around this case, and I think the justices just said, this is a really new world. We don't know this world. So let's do something really minimal. Let's tweak the criminal law here and make sure that nobody goes to jail just because someone else felt scared. And beyond that, let's let this play out in the lower courts and in the future. And I think that's a big disappointment for a lot of women's groups who wanted to get a clear pronouncement from the court that this is not protected speech. They didn't get that.
Would you agree that those women's groups are right to be concerned? I mean, will this ruling make it harder to prosecute people for threats that are made on Facebook? Gizmodo put it pretty bluntly. It wrote, quote, "The Supreme Court today ruled in favor of people being scary, you should pardon the expression, dicks on the internet." I mean, is that an exaggeration?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm looking at this Pew study that says 25% of women have been sexually harassed online. 26% of women have been stalked online. You know, there are women's groups who are saying that 90% of the initial violence directed toward women before it becomes, you know, face-to-face violence is online violence. And I read a quote that the internet is the 21st century crime scene, you know, that this is a place where horrific, horrific threats and violence are aimed particularly at women. And I do think that by saying we're going to focus on the intent of the harasser and not the reaction of the listener, of course I think those groups are right to be disturbed. I think they're right to say, you know, now he's just going to say, oh, I was kidding, or, you know, it was art, or the kinds of things that you say when you're trying to defend the fact that you were terrorizing someone. And so it does seem to me as though there are real consequences for women.
Now, under the First Amendment, You're allowed to threaten people, aren't you?
Sure, and you're allowed to harass people, and you're allowed to do all sorts of things. There are several exceptions that are carved out of the First Amendment, right? There's fighting words, there's incitement, there's obscenity. And one of the things that is not protected speech is something called true threats. And it's a very, very complicated doctrine, and it's not invoked very often. So we don't really understand what a true threat is, and there certainly has never been a case that's clarified in internet land what a true threat is. The question was supposed to be, is this a true threat or should this kind of language be protected? And that's the First Amendment question that the court simply ducked this mm-hmm. week.
It's a particularly difficult case for those of us who are, I won't say free speech absolutists, but we get pretty close to it because the lyrics that Alon has posted are just horrifying, regardless of what he says he was doing. You know, things like, there's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you, and I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood, dying from all the little cuts. Hurry up and die so I can... Anyway, I'm not even going to go through, but it's pretty bad. And I am not an aficionado of rap music, so I don't know how to judge it. All I know is that when someone says something, I think our instinct is to think they mean it.
This is a really tricky case for me. I've actually been called out this week for writing on both sides of it. You know, the framers thought we could not be free if we couldn't say what we wanted to. And certainly if the test was not what I intended to say or what I was trying to say, but how other people heard it, I think the framers would be horrified. But the other thing I think that's really important is to understand that even if this case goes back, he may still be quite culpable under even a stricter standard because he also posted things where he was like showing a little map of how to get to her house and, you know, made really what looked like it crossed the line, no matter what the test is. I react the way you do. If someone was posting those things about me online, I would think they were threats, no matter what the mental state requirement is. But one of the things that a lot of people who write and think about the internet felt strongly on Alonis's side is that the internet changes things. It's not a face-to-face threat. Something that you write on your Facebook page, you know, he wasn't tagging her. It was intended, he says, to work out his issues. And that in this brave new world where things can be yanked out of context and seen by millions of people, it's just not the same as the rules that govern how we talk face-to-face.
I agree with all of that. It's not the same. And he didn't tag her, but he posted a map to her house.
Again, this is such a hard case because it looks to me as though he intended to terrorize her. And so even under a higher standard, I suspect he could still be found guilty. You know, and I've talked to women whose lives have been destroyed by words written online. And I do think we need to think about it in a really systematic way in our criminal law, which we haven't done. But I do think at the end of the day, we just have to circle back to the fact that there's a reason that the framers thought that we needed to be free to say what we're saying. And I think Anthony Alonis would say, my words, my fantasies about hurting my estranged wife are no different from what Eminem wrote about his wife, and that was considered great art.
Thank you, Dahlia.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Brooke. It's always a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate.
Coming up, the sun set on some provisions of the Patriot Act, and me torpedoing a long career as a Good Morning America talking head.
This is On the Media.
Have you ever had an encounter with someone that left you feeling a little braver?
I remember getting in a car and just driving. And it was just for curiosity's sake. That freedom led to, like, a lot of rediscoveries. Just for life, things became colorful again.
Join me, Helga Davis, for conversations with artists and thinkers who share my passion for living fearlessly. It's a new season of Helga. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When we left you at the end of our full hour on the Patriot Act last week, the hammer was about to fall on three of the Act's provisions, and fall it did. In a last-minute session on the Hill Sunday night, the Senate couldn't agree, again, on passing a set of reforms known as the USA Freedom Act, which the House had passed in mid-May. So those three provisions sunsetted as scheduled at midnight, including Section 215. That's the part of the law the NSA used to justify the collection of metadata from your phone calls.
2 days later, the Senate finally passed the USA Freedom Act to rein in the metadata program somewhat, and President Obama signed it into law later that night. Since the revelations of Edward Snowden, Section 215 of the Patriot Act has been best known as the provision used to sanction NSA mass surveillance. But back in 2002, it was known as
the so-called library provision.
Opponents of it refer to it as the library provision.
Section 215, what we're calling the library provision.
Brooke, you know that for many years I commented on advertising for Good Morning America, right?
Yeah.
But did you know that I had kind of a dust-up with Diane Sawyer back in 2002 about this very thing? It was about my pick that she wasn't too thrilled about for TV Ad of the Year, and I picked it. It was a public service announcement because I found it highly ironic.
Well, I haven't heard it, so let's play it.
Excuse me. I can't seem to find these anywhere.
Huh. These books are no longer available.
I didn't know.
May I have your name, please?
Why?
Excuse me.
What did I do?
We just have a couple of questions.
It's a campaign about what if there were no American democracy? What if the world were like this? And it's very chilling, very Twilight Zone. The irony is, in the post 9/11 environment, America is like that. They are taking books out of the library, and they are watching our library behavior. Under Attorney General Ashcroft, things have changed.
Well, again, Bob Garfield, with his opinions, as always, of the ads of the year. And as we say, it's an unusual and earnest year. Thanks a lot. Coming up next.
Your contract was dropped pretty shortly after that, right?
Yeah, this turned out to be pretty expensive opinions. ABC said they didn't fire me because of that, but they did drop my contract, so there you are.
Maybe Diane Sawyer's view was obstructed a little by her, you know, very large flag pin.
Was she really wearing a flag pin?
I don't know, Bob. Just read the next intro.
The American Library Association has opposed the practices of Section 215 for more than a decade and said this week that the passage of the USA Freedom Act was cause for celebration, but that there is still more work to be done. Karen Duffin reports on how libraries became a headliner in the battle against Section 215 starting all those years ago.
It was October 28th, 2001.
Deborah Caldwell Stone, a deputy director at the American Library Association, was sitting in her office when her boss walked in with a huge stack of paper.
It was 385 pages long.
It was the entire text of the Patriot Act, which had just passed. She asked Deborah to read it carefully and to flag anything that she thought might be wrong with the law.
And I was starting to read this one portion. It was Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And it talked about providing information without any probable cause, any tangible thing, in secret, under a gag order. And I just said, this is wrong. This is unconstitutional.
But this was only 6 weeks after 9/11. So if the ALA poked holes in the Patriot Act, they'd risk public backlash. Or worse, political retribution. They'd be biting the Congress that fed them. But this wasn't the first time that librarians had clashed with the FBI.
Up next on C-SPAN, a House Judiciary Subcommittee hears testimony on the Bureau's plan to conduct surveillance at certain libraries across the country.
That was a 1988 congressional hearing about what was called the Library Awareness Program, which sounds like a nice local outreach effort. But according to Allison Macrina, founder of the Library Freedom Project, it actually was
a secret program to spy on the library records because, and I'm not making this up, the FBI believed that librarians were secret KGB agents and that libraries were secret KGB recruitment centers.
Outraged librarians got assurances from the FBI that they would end the program. But just to be sure, they then spent years getting laws or resolutions passed in all 50 states, which would guarantee special privacy protections for libraries. But, says the ALA's Caldwell Stone, When they read Section 215 in 2001, it just felt a little bit too much like 1988.
We went and talked about why it was patriotic to oppose the Patriot Act rather than to support it, and why it was a core issue for libraries.
In fact, protecting the privacy of library patrons is a foundational value for librarians, kind of like doctors and their do-no-harm oath. Because librarians see libraries as a safe space for curiosity, especially about topics that people might consider dangerous or sensitive, like a medical question. They say library patrons in particular need this safe space, as Allison McCrina explains.
We serve members of communities who are under more surveillance in greater proportion than they represent of the general population.
Immigrants, low-income populations, people of color, activists.
These are our communities.
So librarians, they rallied their community.
On a recent weekend at the public library, college students checked out the most controversial books they could find. It was a protest against the provisions of the Patriot Act that allow the FBI to more easily examine library records in their hunt for foreign terrorists.
At this point, the government began to fight back.
Today's speech by Attorney General John Ashcroft was billed as the first in a cross-country campaign.
But Ashcroft kept his speaking tour secret. So the ALA put out a call.
John Ashcroft would sweep into town, speak to law enforcement officers in a closed meeting.
Emily Sheketoff runs ALA's Washington office.
The librarians found out, and protesters would be out in front of whatever venue he was going to be in, and the media would go there, and the only people they had to talk to were us. And Ashcroft was getting more and more frustrated. And he takes off after the American Library Association says we're promoting hysteria.
They considered this a sexist comment. Librarians are predominantly women, but they decided to own it. The ALA made buttons that read,
I am a hysteric librarian, which everyone proudly wore.
John Ashcroft eventually apologized to the head of the ALA. And meanwhile, librarians rallied enough public support to help pass over 400 local resolutions denouncing the Patriot Act. And in a reprise of 1988, they pushed for legislation. Here's Vermont's then-Congressman Bernie Sanders in 2003 introducing
the Freedom to Read Protection Act, which would amend Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act.
Which lost in a tie, 210 to 210. So librarians got increasingly creative. One of the biggest things they were worried about were national security letters. These are basically super secret subpoenas, and the Patriot Act made it easier for law enforcement to issue these letters. And they now came with a perpetual gag order, which meant that if you got a letter, you could never speak of it.
So you can't say the FBI has come to the library and requested patron information, but you can say the FBI has not come to the library and requested patron information.
Allison McCrina said that libraries started posting so-called canary warrant signs in libraries, which say,
the FBI has not been here today. Watch closely for this sign to be removed.
But mostly librarians figured that the best way to protect their patrons' privacy was to have nothing to protect. So after a book was returned, the record of its borrower was deleted, and they started shredding paper records daily. Then in 2006, when the Patriot Act came up for renewal, Deputy Attorney General James Comey told librarians that they were safe from Section 215.
We've never used it in connection with a library or bookstore, as the Attorney General has said.
Librarians and library executives like George Christian in Connecticut breathed a little easier.
Much to my relief, the Attorney General insisted loudly and often that the Patriot Act had not been and never would be used against libraries. So we went on to other concerns.
But then, 4 weeks after Comey's testimony,
two agents came through this door, asked for me. They were right here. And there was a nice, well-dressed young man in a blazer. And then behind him was a much larger person wearing a spandex shirt. So I had no doubt about how robust he was. I was very amused. I took it as a good cop, bad cop thing.
Christian is the executive director of a consortium called the Library Connection. They provide technology to 30 local libraries.
He showed me the letter right here.
A national security letter, or NSL, something John Ashcroft said had never been served on a library. But because of that gag order attached to NSLs, while the DOJ was saying this,
we've never used it in connection with a library or bookstore.
Christian in Connecticut, who knew that was a lie, couldn't say a word. After the FBI left, he called his lawyer.
So I said, well, the FBI was here. I told them to get lost. So now what do I do? And she said, well, unfortunately, your only option is to sue the Attorney General of the United States. That was a little bit bigger than I had envisioned. So I decided I would just call the executive committee.
They told him immediately.
Let's sue those SOBs.
The ACLU took the case, and Christian and the three other members of his committee sued the Attorney General, asking the FBI to show probable cause and to rescind their gag order.
All we wanted to do was just raise our hands and say, you know, we're librarians and we got a national security letter, so don't listen to the Attorney General.
The Connecticut librarians' names leaked to the press, and they became a media sensation. They were dubbed the Connecticut Four. But they were still bound by that gag order and were terrified of breaking it. They stopped answering their phones. They couldn't even tell their families.
One afternoon when I was under the gag order, my son came up to me and he said, a reporter called the house and they said they wanted to talk to you about the FBI investigating you. What's going on?
Peter Chase was one of the Connecticut Four.
For months afterwards, all I could think about is, what does my own son think I have done?
Their case was moving faster than expected. But before it could be resolved, the Department of Justice had a sudden change of heart.
Our attorneys got a call from the Justice Department and said, we've been thinking about your clients. They said, we've decided they're not such bad guys after all. We're going to take away their gag order.
Making these four small-town librarians the first people ever allowed to speak publicly about a national security letter. But it was too late to weigh in on the Patriot Act renewal that had passed just weeks earlier. As George Christian said at the press conference, it was like being allowed to call the fire department after your house burned down. Still, this lawsuit, says the ALA's Caldwell Stone, was a vindication of sorts.
No, we weren't hysterics. Yes, you are doing this. And we had a vehicle to actually point to and talk about the impact of what this kind of law had on libraries.
But in 2013, after the revelations of Edward Snowden and a new administration, this one professing a love of transparency, librarians recognized that nothing much has changed. The other challenge to patrons' privacy? Patrons themselves. We've gotten so used to giving our data away, or rather exchanging it for things like Amazon's, if you liked this, you might also like that, recommendations. Library users are starting to ask for these same kinds of services from libraries, services that require data collection and storage. Libraries may be the last institution on earth fighting not to get our data. Most library systems require you to opt in to have your data stored, which doesn't seem to matter as much to their patrons. Peter Chase of the Connecticut Four.
People say to us all the time, I have not committed any crimes. My life is an open book. I don't care if they listen in on my conversations. And so to them I say, do you have curtains at your windows at home? I'll bet you do, and I'll bet sometimes you draw them because you want privacy, and sometimes you open them up to have light, but you are the ones who decide, not the government.
So librarians spend a lot of their time helping people weigh these trade-offs, and if people do want privacy, teaching them how to pull the curtains. Macrina's Library Freedom Project does just that. With help from the Knight Foundation, she and an ACLU attorney have created workshops on how to maintain privacy online.
I'm trying to bring these tools to ordinary people, and right now they're sort of in the realm of like the technological elite.
Knight is also funding the San Jose Public Library to create a privacy app. The app teaches people about privacy while they play a Mario-like game.
Side-scroller game where you'll jump up and hit the box and run down.
It asks you which privacy issues you care about or don't care about.
Based on your answers to those questions, you're actually given a personalized privacy path.
Aaron Burma manages the app.
And so the resources that you'll be given are tailored custom just for you.
Projects like Burma's and Macrina's help people make personal privacy choices. Meanwhile, librarians debate how or if to hold the line as a profession. George Christian says this was his main lesson from fighting their national security letter.
Our civil liberties are protected by our individual willingness to insist that the Bill of Rights be honored, that it's just not automatic. We have to be personally involved.
And while you are deciding how or if you want to be involved, don't worry, librarians have your back.
Have you even seen the ALA's Freedom to Read statement? It's like got gravitas. Like you have to read it in front of a stadium. The last line is my favorite. And it's basically like, this is why we will always support people's freedom to read. The last line is, freedom itself is a dangerous way of life, but it is ours. Librarians, right? I know.
For On the Media, I'm Karen Duffin.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Kat Tier Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.